Like that? Good afternoon. Good to see you all. Thank you very much for the special music at choir. I was going to take a little bit of time to let you get back to your places, but Mr. Trebig gave me a very important announcement, and I'm very appreciative of it, because not only is it a waste to talk and have nobody here, it's intimidating to have the mic looking you right in the face. So good to pull it down. What a wonderful day. Feast of Tabernacles has finally arrived. Seems like we wait a very long time for the feast, and that's partly because we start preparing so far in advance, which is, of course, necessary. But many of us have known where we are going and perhaps had various kinds of planning going on for a very long time. Of course, the feast began last night at sundown. We had a very edifying service here last night with those who were able to be here, and a great kickoff message from Mr. Trebig. He and I were discussing sermon topics afterwards and our history and sort of remembering some of the things we have spoken about and heard others speak about. And there's always so much to cram into a feast, and yet it's a little bit difficult from year to year to know exactly what you want to cover and how to cover it. And it reminded me that maybe I should mention to you that it would be good to remember that all of the sermons and sermonette topics are basically intended to come together as a diet. You know, think of it as taking your plate and putting all the different things on it that you want to eat when you have perhaps a buffet or a salad bar or something. You might get lots of different things, and okay, they might taste just fine as a standalone, but they're even better when you put them all together and make a great meal out of it, and that's really what the Feast of Tabernacles is supposed to be. So I hope you have at least enough in your mind as you go from day to day to remember a little bit about the tone and the direction and the purpose of the material that we're covering, so that you can get the most out of it. Speaking of plates and buffets, since we have tea and coffee, and he invited us to bring snacks or whatever, if any of you plan to bring in pancakes, eggs, and things like that, let me know. I'll come early. Now, you have to bring turkey bacon, though. I don't want any of that other stuff. So if you're going to do that. Now, I don't think we intend to eat breakfast here per se, but that's a very nice service and a very special opportunity here at the New Braunfels site that most sites would simply not be able to carry off. So I think we should be, as Mr. Peoples already said, we should appreciate that, right, Bob? We should appreciate this opportunity. It's good to see lots of old friends and new friends, and of course, the older I get, the more of them are old friends, and I think we're all feeling that a little bit these days. I'd like to begin the sermon this afternoon with a brief reference to a small historical event, really very small in the scheme of things in the world today. In 1976, the United States Mint began to consider abolishing the current large size dollar, once known, of course, as the silver dollar, and making a new coin that was smaller and lighter so that people would be much more able to carry it around in their pockets. Although the Eisenhower dollar was never widely circulated, the Department of Treasury was nevertheless intent on keeping a dollar coin. We wanted to have a $1 coin. Now, part of that, I think, was motivated by the commercial interests who wanted to be able to use it in vending machines. That usually drives a lot of our government decisions, and it seems to have been the case in that situation. In keeping with the times, they decided to portray a woman on the new, smaller coin, and that certainly seems appropriate even today as we look back at it. All of our money has men on it, and women probably spend as much of it as the men do. It was decided that Susan B. Anthony, a pioneer of women's rights, would be portrayed on the new coin. Most of us, of course, would not recognize Susan B. Anthony, either in profile or in person, because that was quite a long time ago, and most of us never really studied that very thoroughly. maybe some of the ladies would be more likely to say they did. Well, after some research, it was obvious that the coin could be easily confused with a quarter. So to solve that problem, they created 11 sides to the coin to distinguish it from a quarter. So they printed an 11-sided coin with a rim around it and mounted a huge marketing campaign to educate the public. Some of you will know just by your own memory that all of that was to no avail. It was to no avail because people were not comfortable with changing to an 11-sided quarter-sized dollar. The public was still confused, and the dollar was never circulated widely. It, of course, has since been pulled out of circulation and a Sacagawea dollar introduced, which I don't think has had too much success either, except, again, maybe in the vending machines. The point of this story is that once we get comfortable with doing things a certain way, we really hate to change. That's pretty much a trait of mankind, that once we get comfortable with doing things our way, we do not want to change. There's something wrong with that. We do have an irony here. Let's notice in Malachi chapter 3 a statement that we are quite familiar with, and it's a good thing. Malachi chapter 3. In Malachi chapter 3, in verse 6, we find this statement, a quote from God himself, actually from Yahweh, who is Christ, the God of the Old Testament. But he says here, "For I am the eternal, I do not change. Therefore, you are not consumed, O sons of Jacob." Sorry, that's Jacob. There we go. "Therefore, you are not consumed, you sons of Jacob." Well, he's saying, because I made certain promises and certain prophecies are in effect, I'm not going to just wipe you off the map. I'm going to let it go. But I don't change. And you and I depend on that every day of our lives. It's repeated in Hebrews chapter 13, if you want the New Testament version, Hebrews chapter 13, verse 8. Hebrews chapter 13, verse 8. Paul puts it this way. "Jesus Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever." Christ is the same yesterday, today, and forever. So he says in the Old Testament, "I don't change." He inspires Paul to write in the New Testament, "He doesn't change. He's the same yesterday, and today, and forever." So why do we have to change? Why does man have to change? You know the simple answer, don't you? The simple answer is man is not anything at all like God. Man is not like God. God created us in his image and gave a certain potential to become like God, but we are not like God. In fact, in most things, we are diametrically opposite to God. And God makes that clear to us. Isaiah chapter 55. Isaiah 55, 5, 5. That's for those of you like me that are hard of hearing, because when I say 55, I'm not even sure I hear myself correctly. It could be 55 or 65, but I'm saying 5-5, 55. Isaiah 55, very powerful chapter, but let's just take a little bit out of here in verse 8. Isaiah 55, verse 8, "For my thoughts are not your thoughts, nor are your ways my ways, says the Eternal. For as the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts." Okay, God doesn't change, but God is already perfect. God doesn't need to change. God isn't going to change, but God's thoughts are not our thoughts, and God's ways are not our ways, and vice versa. God isn't going to change. We need to change. This Feast of Tabernacles among many pictures that we have from this feast. One of them is that the world is going to change, and this feast is about a new world government. Now, man has toyed with the idea and speculated on the idea of world government for generations. Man has even tried it a few times. Again, to no avail. But this feast is about world government, about a different world government, the only world government that could or would ever work. And we've come here to learn to fear the eternal God always, which means to love Him, to stand in awe of Him, to worship Him, as we heard last night, as the creator of the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that's in them, and the ruler and governor over it all. So we're here to worship God and recognize that God is soon going to intervene in world affairs, and man's life is going to make dramatic changes. Man thinks he can govern himself. Since the Garden of Eden, man has attempted to govern himself. In fact, with Satan's influence, he has governed himself in all kinds of ways and still done a miserable job. I ran across something a few years ago that I haven't heard repeated for a while. I wanted to share it with you today. It's kind of an observation on some of man's theories of government, and government and economics are often thoroughly entwined. Some of you will be familiar with it, especially from the corporate world. It is looking at government in the context of two cows. All right, two cows. So I'll give you the definitions. And I want you not to bother to write these down. There's not going to be a test on this, and you don't need to know it after you walk out the door. I just want you to understand it for a basic background of where we're going. Socialism. Man has tried socialism. Here's how we describe socialism. You have two cows. You give one to your neighbor. That's it. Communism. You have two cows. The state takes both of them and gives you some milk. It's okay. This is not intended to be serious. You can laugh if you like. Fascism. You have two cows. The state takes both of them and sells you some milk. Nazism, which of course is a form of fascism. You have two cows. The state takes both and shoots you. Bureaucratism. We might say prevalent in democracy, the bureaucracy of democracy. You have two cows. The state takes both, shoots one, milks the other, and then throws the milk away. Then there's traditional capitalism, which is the ideal of democracy. You have two cows. You sell one and buy a bull. Your herd multiplies and the economy grows. You sell the herd and retire on the income. That sounds pretty good. Maybe why we think we should live in a democracy in today's world. Unfortunately, that's not really the way it works, is it? No, it works like this. You have two cows. You sell three of them to your publicly listed company using letters of credit opened by your brother at the bank. Then you execute a debt equity swap with an associated general offer so that you get all four cows back with a tax exemption for five cows. The milk rights of the six cows are transferred via an intermediary to a Cayman Island company, secretly owned by the majority shareholder, who sells the rights to all seven cows back to your listed company. The annual report says the company owns eight cows with an option on one more. I think these are pretty clever takes on man's way of taking care of business, both government and economic. They're kind of funny. But if you stop and think about it, you find that it's always about getting and taking. It's always about getting and taking. Government always seems to serve the ruler the governor more than it serves the citizens or the governed. That's man's way of life. Now, that shouldn't come as any surprise to us. Back in 1 Samuel chapter 8, 1 Samuel chapter 8, when Israel demanded a king so they could be like all the rest of the nations, which, of course, God had thoroughly warned them in advance of coming out of Egypt, or at least on the way out of Egypt, that they should not do, that they should not look around them to see how to worship or how to govern or how to do anything. They should look to God and to God's instruction. But God knew their human nature and knew what they would do, and so we have these instructions in 1 Samuel chapter 8, verse 10. So Samuel told all the words of the Eternal. Notice these words come from God. Samuel told all the words of the Eternal to the people who asked him for a king. And he said, now I want you to notice certain words that pop up here over and over. He said, this will be the behavior of the king who will reign over you. He will take your sons and appoint them for his own chariots and to be his horsemen, and some will run before his chariots. He will appoint captains over his thousands and captains over his fifties, will set some to plow his ground and reap his harvest, and some to make his weapons of war and equipment for his chariots. He will take your daughters to be perfumers, cooks, and bakers. And he will take the best of your fields, your vineyards, and your olive groves, and give them to his servants. And he will take your male servants, your female servants, your finest young men, and your donkeys, and put them to his work. He will take a tenth of your sheep, and you will be his servants. What's the upshot of all of that? Verse 18 says, and you will cry out in that day. You will cry out in that day because of your king whom you have chosen for yourselves, and the Eternal will not hear you in that day. You have rejected God, which Israel, of course, much more directly did in one sense than the rest of the world, because Israel was specifically called and given an opportunity for physical relationship with God, not salvation specifically. But Israel rejected God's way and went after its own ways and the ways of the nations around it. And God prophesied, you will cry out because of the way you're treated. And of course they did. Now God intervened a couple of times in the cases of David and Solomon. Even then, of course, some of those things happened. But overall, Israel had at least some brief history of reasonable government with some involvement of God and God's word. But it still failed, as you know. History proves in living color that man's governments do not work. Sorry for those of you who are politically minded and motivated in one sense, but I think you're wasting your time. Man's governments do not work. And almost every last one of them has been about taking to enrich the leaders at the expense of the citizenry, even though that taking is sometimes subtle and a bit behind the scenes. It's the condition of the world today. But you and I are here today to acknowledge, as we have on trumpets and atonement, and through this feast specifically, that a new world government is coming. A great change is coming in the world. Life is going to be very different for citizens of the millennial period under the rulership of Jesus Christ. Man's going to be governed by Christ, who takes over this world's government from the banished Satan the devil at trumpets and through atonement, and of course is established in form and picture by this feast. Isaiah chapter 9, if you will, Isaiah chapter 9. We need to keep that focus in mind. We will be given lots of information and lots of different perspectives and, shall we say, angles on the message that God is giving us during this feast. But it's all going to come down to Christ rules over the earth and what changes that will produce, and we'll hear some of that as well. Isaiah 9, verse 6, here's the prophecy of this age to come. For unto us a child is born, unto us a son is given. You can tell just by reading those two lines, in a sense, that something special is happening here. And the government will be upon his shoulder. And his name will be called Wonderful, Counselor, Mighty God, Everlasting Father, Prince of Peace. Now, this includes the offices and attributes of both the Father and the Son, in a sense, but the Son, of course, has the attributes of his Father and is just a die-cast image of his Father. And so it's talking, of course, about Christ coming to rule the nations under his Father, who is ultimately God over all. So we know Christ is going to rule over the whole world, don't we? That's not news to us. It's good news, and it's good news we ought to be reminded of from time to time, and certainly during this feast. We know he's going to rule over the world, but how is he going to rule? How is Christ going to govern compared to or contrasted with those things that I read to you somewhat humorously about the way man has governed himself, or the way God described the king that would rule over us? How did Christ tell his disciples to rule? How did he tell them to lead the church? Let's go to Matthew chapter 20. Matthew chapter 20. I entitled this sermon in the pre-feast discussions with the ministry, The Nature of Government During the Millennium. The Nature of Government. Because it's all about the nature in the sense of the intrinsic values and capacity and attitude and approach of the governing body that changes everything in the millennium. Matthew chapter 20, verse 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to him with her sons, kneeling down and asking something from him. And he said to her, "What do you wish?" She said to him, "Grant that these two sons of mine may sit, one on your right hand and the other on the left, in your kingdom." Sometimes when I read the various passages that call her the mother of Zebedee's children, I wonder, why is her name never given? At first I think maybe it's because she was humble and quiet and didn't want herself put forward, didn't want her name bandied about. And then I get to that part that says, "Let my two sons sit on your right hand and left and be the most important people under you in the kingdom." And I think, no, it's probably that God just didn't think she needed to be named. Just don't embarrass her. Leave her alone. Jesus answered and said, "You do not know what you ask. Are you able to drink the cup that I'm about to drink?" He's speaking to the sons here. "And to be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with?" They said to him, "We are able." Now, mother came to make the request, but it was clear that he knew that the sons were the ones angling for the job. Now, these are disciples who are about to become apostles. "We're able." Sound like a political campaign. We're able to do everything in the world while we're running a political campaign, at whatever level, from school board to president of the United States. It's different after you get the job. "So he said to them, 'You will indeed drink my cup and be baptized with the baptism that I am baptized with, but to sit on my right hand and on my left is not mine to give.'" An interesting concept in itself. Christ said, even though I'm going to be ruling in the kingdom, some of my highest staff is going to be chosen for me, and that's okay with me. It's not mine to give. There again, that's a little different than a political leader or a tyrant, a king lording it over his people. I will decide what I will do and when I will do it and whom I will use and whom I will not. That's the way it's going to be. It's not mine to give, but it is for those for whom it is prepared of my Father. You see right away that Christ himself was allowing for a humility in leadership, an attitude that I don't have to have total, absolute control of every detail of the government. When the ten heard it, they were greatly displeased with the two brothers. Okay, the two are in trouble because they're angling for a special job, but now the other ten get upset. They want their share of leadership and rulership. They want their place in Christ's government. Probably got a little out of hand. But Jesus called them to himself and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and those who are great exercise authority over them," as I've just described it. "Yet it shall not be so among you." There it is. It shall not be so among you. "But whoever desires to become great among you, let him be your servant. And whoever desires to be first among you, let him be your slave. Just as the Son of Man." Now, he's in a pretty good position to make this point because he's the creator of all things and he's giving his life for the world. "Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life a ransom for many." So Christ turns the model commonly used in the world around them. Interestingly, he said, the Gentiles do it this way. There's no reason to believe the Jews didn't do it that way as well, all the Israelites. But he didn't want them to probably turn off, or as some of us can, just pull out your hearing aids. You don't hear anything else. And so he said, this is what the Gentiles do, but it shall not be so among you. Don't let that happen. Instead, there is an attitude of service that goes along with leadership and rulership. Christ said, you are all wrong. Not only the two brothers, but the other ten. You're all wrong. This is not how leadership is supposed to work. Now, before we jump to wrong conclusions, does this mean that there is no real authority in God's kingdom? There's no real authority in the millennial rule of Christ? Nobody who can enforce the law? Is the rule of Christ going to produce confusion? Is everyone going to be equal? And everybody going to be free to do that which is right in his own eyes, which the scripture clearly shows produces destruction? Is that how it's going to be? Is that what God is talking about? Well, let's look at a quick example we've often turned to during the Feast of Tabernacles in Zechariah chapter 14. Zechariah chapter 14. Verse 16, Zechariah 14, verse 16. "And it shall come to pass that everyone who is left of all the nations which came against Jerusalem in the end of the age shall go up from year to year to worship the King, the Eternal of Hosts, and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles." Everybody who fought against Jerusalem, all the nations, it says. And we're not given exactly who all that is. But they're going to have to come up year to year, over and over again, repeatedly, to worship the King and to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. All right, does that get enforced? Or is that just a good idea circulated among people through the newspaper and hope that they'll show up? Verse 17, "It shall be that whichever of the families of the earth do not come up to Jerusalem to worship the King, the Eternal of Hosts, on them there will be no rain." A little bit more focused punishment that any of us could mete out or any modern government could rule out. Man can't make that happen. Tyrants have done all kinds of things and destroyed millions of their own citizens, but they can't make it stop raining. This, of course, is, again, based in an agricultural society, the lesson is there. But rain is fundamental to life in any case and in any kind of society. There will be no rain. "If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain." We've always speculated that this little "if" here is kind of a tongue-in-cheek. "If the family of Egypt will not come up." What he's probably saying is, since we know Egypt won't come up, they'll have no rain. If the family of Egypt will not come up and enter in, they shall have no rain. They shall receive the plague with which the Eternal strikes the nations who do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. This shall be the punishment of Egypt and the punishment of all the nations that do not come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. The feast is going to be enforced for a period of time on the nations who have rejected God's way and who have fought against Israel, who have a history of rejecting God. It's going to be a very different environment. God is going to say, come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. You're commanded to come to keep the feast. And some nations apparently are going to say, well, we just can't do that right now. And we don't really worship you. We don't really trust you. Why should we come up? But the Creator of the heavens, the earth, the sea, and all that is in them has the power to say, well, partly because if you don't come up, it's going to hurt really bad for a while because you're going to have no rain. Of course, this is just an example of the kind of things that God can do, that Christ can do as the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. Now keep in mind, this is not just revenge or some kind of tyrannical vanity being played out here. Christ is not just saying, hey, I'm in charge here, I'll do it if I please. This is for their good. What did we read in Matthew 20? Let him be your servant. When Christ tells the nations to come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, it's the same as it is when he tells you and me to come up to keep the Feast of Tabernacles. He is serving them with truth that will change their lives. You and I wouldn't be here if our lives had not been changed by the truth of God and the Word of God and the commandments of God, the law of God that represents the very life of God. We're here because God commanded us to keep the feast, and we chose to obey that command because God worked in us to convict us that that was good for us and will ultimately be good for the world. When Christ punishes nations to make them come to keep the Feast of Tabernacles, it's not for his good. It's for their good. It's to teach them lessons that are fundamental to life in a whole new society, where God's law is the only law that counts. Some of us are old enough to remember Gene Autry and Back in the Saddle Again, where he sang in the chorus, the only law is right. You know, you have to understand what the phrase means, but he says, the only law you have to live by is right. It's like saying the law of love. Whatever is right is the law. Well, that's the way it's going to be in this day and age. Let's go back to Isaiah chapter 9 for a moment and look at how that government changes things. Isaiah chapter 9. We were here earlier and just read verse 6 intentionally, but I want to read verse 7 to you now. It picks up after it says the government will be on his shoulders, and says in verse 7, of the increase of his government and peace. We'll hear more about peace during this feast. There will be no end upon the throne of David, because Christ is going to sit on the throne of David, and over his kingdom to order it and establish it with judgment and justice. Bad judgment, false judgment, is of no real value. Personal, selfish judgment is of no value. But judgment with justice, just and righteous judgment, is a whole different matter. To order it and establish it with judgment and justice from that time forward, even forever, the zeal of the Eternal of Hosts will perform this. The zeal of the Eternal of Hosts will perform this. Over a page to the chapter Mr. Trebig read some of during the offertory. think that's where it was. Maybe it was last night. My brain is already mushing the messages. But that's all right. I want them all in there. Isaiah 11, verse 1. We have heard some of the effects of this. We're going to go back and pick up the cause. For every cause, there is an effect. And we often think about and repeat, and we should, the effect of Christ's government, wherein the wolf lies down with the lamb, and children play on the poison snake den without being hurt. But it begins here in chapter 11, verse 1. There shall come forth a rod from the stem of Jesse. This is out of the family of Jesse, who, of course, is the father of David. And a branch shall grow out of his roots. The Spirit of the Eternal shall rest upon him. So this is now a Spirit-led government, a spiritually mature government that is going to be in place, as it goes on to describe. The Spirit of the Lord shall rest upon him, the Spirit of wisdom and understanding. Wisdom and understanding. Would that we had that somewhere in government today. Not just in the United States, look around the world. Doesn't matter whether you happen to be a Mr. Trump fan or not, whether you happen to be a Republican or a Democrat by heritage. You know, I've never been either. I've never voted one time in my entire life. But if I were either, I suppose I'd be a Democrat because my dad was a dyed-in-the-wool Democrat. And that's where we get a lot of our beliefs and practices, is from our youth and our parents. But it's not about that. It's about wisdom and understanding, the Spirit of counsel and might. No, we in the ministry have to give counsel and judgment sometimes, and we try hard to make sure that we're in line with God's thinking and that we submit to God's will, that we submit to God's inspiration and direction to give counsel. But sometimes we fall short, and sometimes we find out later we didn't discern the facts, and we made a judgment based on what we thought to be true. Christ isn't going to do that. He's going to always know the facts. And always know what's right and what's wrong. The Spirit of counsel and might, wisdom and understanding. Going on to verse 2, the Spirit of knowledge and of the fear of the Eternal. Ah, part of that process is the fear of the Eternal, which we're here to learn, right? We have come to keep the feast that we might learn to fear the Eternal, our God, always. That's part of preparation for the time when we have a part in the God family and the government of Christ. Now, we'll be changed, and God will give us what we have need of, but we're supposed to be desiring and learning to think like God today. Verse 3, his delight is in the fear of the Eternal, and he shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness, righteousness. That's a perfect character of God. With righteousness he shall judge the poor. The poor get a short straw most of the time in today's governments. In some governments, they're virtually eliminated. With righteousness he shall judge the poor and decide with equity. That's equality, a proper balance of right and wrong, knowing that fairness here is fairness there, that it's all based on objective, righteous judgment. Decide with equity for the meek of the earth, those who might not otherwise get a hearing. Sometimes in today's world, you have to be pretty assertive to even get a hearing. We had a small problem this year in Houston, which we haven't had before. I haven't actually talked to Mr. Servideo about this. I don't know if they had it in the north side. But we have a few families in one specific school district that this year decided for some reason they didn't want to cooperate with kids leaving school to go to the Holy Days. We haven't had that in years. And as those of you who've had children in Texas schools probably know, you that are visitors would not, we have had the benefit of a judgment made way back in about 1981, or was it 91? I guess it was 91, in Texas based on a lawsuit that came about between the church and the school board of Amarillo, I believe it was. And that judgment was that the school board was completely off base and out of touch and that the church had the right to take our children to the holy days and to the Feast of Tabernacles, and even the right to have some travel time before and after. And that's all on the Texas law books today. And long-term experienced school administrators know that, but new, eager, ambitious, young school administrators often don't know that, and they want to make their mark by saying, our school is not going to allow this. Now, I do, and this was in the same school district I live in. It's one of the biggest school districts in the country, really, 75,000 students. And all of a sudden, they didn't want to let kids out of school. Well, suffice to say that after some persuasion, without even having our lawyer thrown into the mix, though I was keeping him in touch, our families managed to fight their own battle, really, with the school system. We thought we'd start with that. And ultimately, the attendance supervisor who was talking to them said, okay, we're just going to leave it alone this year. You know, we had it before the lawyer, but he didn't even really get around to looking at it. So we're going to ignore it this year. Just go on and do what you always do. Now, that may mean that the battle is yet to be fought. But it's interesting. They cannot look at the facts and make a righteous judgment because they don't know what the law says. You have to know and understand the law to be able to do that. He shall not judge by the sight of his eyes, nor decide by the hearing of his ears, but with righteousness he shall judge the poor. That's the whole point. With equity, he shall strike the earth with the rod of his mouth. They had to be a bit assertive because the meek of the earth don't always get heard. And with the breath of his lips, he shall slay the wicked. Verse 5, righteousness shall be the belt of his loins and faithfulness the belt of his waist. So Christ is going to be righteous and he's going to be faithful to that righteousness and faithful to God's way and faithful to God's law. And he's going to have the power to carry out that judgment and that justice, and all of mankind is going to benefit from that kind of government. But do they know that? Are humans going to be happy with Christ ruling? Are they going to be happy with Christ taking over and changing the way they do things? Revelation chapter 11. Revelation chapter 11 says, no, they won't be too happy. This is a whole lot bigger deal than a Susan B. Anthony dollar now. That's beware, we're not talking about the same thing. We're talking about the same attitude. We're talking about the same comfort zone. We're talking about, I don't want anybody messing up my routine or my life, getting in the way of the way I want to do things. So in Revelation 11, verse 15, Revelation 11, verse 15, we might have covered this on the Feast of Trumpets. Then the seventh angel sounded, and there were loud voices in heaven saying, the kingdoms of this world have become the kingdoms of our Lord and of his Christ, and he shall reign forever and ever. The kingdoms are going to be taken over. They're going to be absorbed. They are going to become the kingdom of God. Christ is going to rule over them. What does it say in verse 18? The nations were angry. The nations were angry. And your wrath has come. God has to enforce things that human beings need because they are not willing to submit to them on their own. Satan the devil is very effective today. And even when Christ returns, human nature and the after effects of all that we've been influenced to believe by Satan the devil will be raging and stirred up. And human beings will say, we don't want this Christ to reign over us. Now, many of them, of course, will probably be deceived to believe that he is some alien from outer space that they should reject. But even those who apparently will know that he is Christ, in many cases, will be angry. What do they do about it? Chapter 17, Revelation 17. Revelation 17, verse 14. These will make war with the Lamb. Wow. mankind so set in his ways, so determined to have his own way, so determined not to have authority over him. These will make war with the Lamb, and the Lamb will overcome them. For he is Lord of lords and King of kings, and those who are with him are called, chosen, and faithful. Those who meet Christ in the air when he comes back to this earth. The saints who are with him are called and chosen and faithful. But he's going to have to fight a battle. They're going to make war with the Lamb. And they lose. Guess what? They lose. But guess what else? They win. They have to lose to win. They have to be conquered as you and I had to be conquered and be converted to accept Christ as our ruler and our God in order to win. The nations are going to fight against Christ. Christ is going to defeat them completely and totally, crush them, and then have mercy upon them. So they lose big time, and then they win because now they can humble themselves and be taught by him. They can start to think about a different way of life, one they've really never contemplated before. We go back to Isaiah chapter 2, where Mr. Peoples read to us earlier, Isaiah chapter 2. And again, Mr. Trabig, I think, might have read this last night, and he mentioned we'll probably go over some of this time and again, and that's quite all right. I have no problem with repeating what God says about these marvelous and wonderful times. Isaiah chapter 2, verse 2, now it shall come to pass in the latter days that the mountain of the Eternal's house, that's referring to his kingdom, his government, the mountain here is symbolic of a government, shall be established on the top of the mountains, all the rest of the kingdoms. He is King of kings and Lord of lords. And shall be exalted above the hills, even the little nations. Everybody's coming under Christ's rule. And all nations shall flow to it. Probably going to be a process that looks like flowing. Some start and then others, and God is bringing and calling and instructing and commanding or whatever it takes. So that if Egypt doesn't come up that first year to keep the feast, it's another whole year before the nation of Egypt shows up to keep the feast. They have to go through that year without rain, evidently, at least again by example. All nations shall flow to it. But how do they come? What's their attitude? What's their mindset? What is it now? We don't want anybody to rule over us. I want to do my own thing. I want to have my own way. Verse 3, many people shall come and say, come to each other, to one another. Come, let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal, to the kingdom of God, to the throne, to Christ's government in Jerusalem. Let us go up to the mountain of the Eternal, to the house of the God of Jacob. Again, a house is often a dynasty. In this case, the house, the governmental power, the ruling family of God, the house of the God of Jacob. And he will teach us his ways. There's a contrast here in this expression. He will teach us his ways. In other words, we have to give up our ways. He will teach us his ways, and we shall walk in his paths. We walk in our own ways. We walk in our own paths. Human beings do it all the time. Sadly, you and I find ourselves doing it from time to time, don't we? We sometimes wander off down our own path. We do our own ways until we suddenly come up short and say, whoa, this isn't right. Maybe we feel a pain. Maybe we feel the penalty. Maybe we get dragged up short by a friend or an angel or some circumstance, and all of a sudden we say, whoa, this isn't right. Well, in this day and age, of course, when they start walking down that wrong path, my way, the angel is going to come along and say, it's not the angel in this case, it is the children of God, going to come along and say, hey, this is the way, walk in it. He'll show us his ways. We'll walk in his paths. Why? For out of Zion, from Christ's throne in Jerusalem, shall go forth the law and the word of the Eternal from Jerusalem. And once again, his judgment comes into play. He shall judge between the nations and rebuke many people. See, people are going to have to be rebuked. They're going to have to be corrected. They're going to have to be taught. They're going to have to be shown that their way does not produce the ultimate result they want. We all had to go through that at repentance to come to see that our way, rational though it may seem, very reasonable though it may be among human beings, does not produce the desired result. We have to get on track with God's way, His law, His way. And so He has to rebuke many people. They shall beat their swords into plowshares and their spears into pruning hooks. Nation shall not lift up sword against nation, neither shall they learn war anymore. We're very familiar with that whole expression, and it even is inscribed in the on the statute of the United Nations. But He's going to teach us His ways. We're going to walk in His paths. And what are they? Luke chapter 6. I regret to tell you that there is no clock on the wall here. That wouldn't be so bad if my watch worked. It's really just for looks. Now we have just a little bit of time. Let's finish up. Luke chapter 6. Verse 27, Luke 6, 27. He's been describing the way human beings think, and he says in verse 27, "But I say to you who hear, love your enemies, do good to those who hate you, bless those who curse you, and pray for those who spitefully use you. To him who strikes you on the one cheek, offer the other also, and from him who takes away your cloak, do not withhold your tunic either. Give to everyone who asks of you, and from him who takes away your goods, do not ask them back." None of this makes any sense in a human world. Makes sense when God's behind it, because God makes it work. Same way He gives the rain in due season. Verse 31, what we call the golden rule. "And just as you want men to do to you, you also do to them likewise." Christ taught this in the middle of a short 3.5-year ministry. What do you think He's going to be teaching during a 1,000-year millennium? What do you think He's going to be teaching those nations when they have to come up to Jerusalem and learn His ways? He's going to be saying, "I say to you, love your enemies. Just as you would have others do to you, do to them also." That's what He's going to be teaching. Because government is going to be for the people. It's going to be a service. It's going to be to serve the citizens, not to take from the citizens. How does this attitude play out today in your life and mine? We can look at a few quick things that He told the church. Colossians chapter 4. These things apply to us today, and they will be taught to the whole world in time to come. Colossians chapter 4, verse 1. Colossians 4, verse 1. "Masters," this is people who had slaves or employees, "masters, give your bondservants," that would be the slaves, "what is just and fair, knowing that you also have a master in heaven." Again, God's able to make that work. He says, "Masters, don't abuse those who are under you. Take care of them, because you have a master as well, and if he chooses to cut you off, you're in big trouble. If it doesn't rain, life gets pretty miserable." Back up a page to chapter 3, just to insert here, since we don't have to come back. Chapter 3, verse 21, here's an example. "Fathers, do not provoke your children, lest they become discouraged." So in today's world, we practice what Christ is telling us in a everyday environment like the home and family. Fathers, don't provoke your children to wrath. Don't discourage your children. Do unto them as you would have them do unto you, even though you're in charge and you have to make the judgments and you have to make the decisions. Over to 1 Peter chapter 3. I go here at risk of being challenged by the participants, but I'm going here anyway. Chapter 3, 1 Peter 3, verse 7. Spend a little bit of time on this in the FI class on marriage in Allen. Verse 7, "Husbands, likewise, dwell with them according to understanding. What's he saying? He's saying the husband in that society was very much the ruler of the household. And that was true, of course, well into the last century, even in America. And certainly during the 1700s, women in America didn't have the vote. They didn't have much say in anything, and they certainly couldn't take their husbands to court for abuse because he was free to discipline them, generally in whatever way he chose. The old saying, a man's home is his castle, meant basically that. He was king. He could do what he chose. But God says to us through Peter, husbands, dwell with them with understanding, giving honor to the wife as the weaker vessel, meaning that she's under authority and she can't really do anything about it. So how are you going to teach her? How are you going to help her? How are you going to treat her? Giving honor to the wife as to the weaker vessel, being heirs together of the grace of life, that your prayers may not be hindered. So a husband and wife are one flesh, and they must think for each other and help each other to think and accomplish what God has given us to do. So whether it's a master over a slave, whether it's a father over a child, or a husband over a wife, whatever the governmental structure is today in the church, in a certain way, it's the ministry over the church. Though again, the authority we exercise is limited absolutely to that which Christ confers upon us. But if you're under the authority in a spiritual sense of a ministry, a pastor, somebody, you can expect and should expect that you will be treated in a Christ-like manner. And if you're not, then of course you have a right to ask for something else. The nature of government is going to be changed. Government will no longer be the enemy, but the best friend. Parents who properly rear their children and give them an understanding of self-discipline and the values of life that will make life work for them are doing them a great service. And that's the kind of government parents should be. It's the kind of government all of us should give to whomever we rule over in whatever minor or major capacity we may have. Government shouldn't be our enemy, as most people in the world today think it is. Government should be our best friend. The nature of government has to change. Nature of government has to change in order to bring about the change in the nature of human beings, to show man how to live like God. Christ isn't just going to come and say, all of you behave. All of you be nice folks. We're going to all have a good time here for the next 1,000 years. Just behave yourself. And meanwhile, I'll do what I want. No, Christ is going to come and set a perfect example and righteously judge and discipline where necessary and encourage and inspire and motivate and provoke to good works, as he tells us to do. And the nature of government is going to change. And then, over time, he's going to convert mankind, literally change their nature to a spiritually motivated nature, to one that has spiritual wisdom and discernment and judgment. He's going to show man how to live as he lives. He's going to show man how to live like God. Isaiah chapter 59, I'm sorry, 55, let's go back there again. I'll go back to Isaiah 55 because, again, we talked a little bit about Christ's rule as described in Isaiah 55, but I want to take it a little bit farther. Isaiah chapter 55, verse 9, where he says, for the heavens are higher than the earth, so are my ways higher than your ways, and my thoughts than your thoughts. For as the rain, now he uses another analogy here to help us understand how Christ is going to change the world. For as the rain comes down and the snow from heaven, and do not return there, but water the earth, they have a purpose, and make it bring forth and bud, that it may give seed to the sower and bread to the eater, so shall my word Now, this is the analogy. My word is like rain. It's like the water. In Egypt's case, they give up the rain, but they eventually receive the word. So shall my word that be that goes forth from my mouth. Remember, out of Zion. It shall not return to me void, but it shall accomplish what I please, and it shall prosper in the thing for which I sent it. For you shall go out with joy and be led out with peace. The mountains and the hills shall break forth into singing before you. That's a different world than you and I know. All the trees of the field shall clap their hands. Again, this is symbolic, but he's talking about everything being positive and happy and joyous and exciting and peaceful. The trees of the field shall clap their hands. Instead of the thorn shall come up the cypress tree. And instead of the briar shall come up the myrtle tree. You see, we're getting here with the plants, the same thing we got in Isaiah chapter 11 with the animals. Here it's the plants. And it shall be to the eternal for a name, for an everlasting sign that shall not be cut off. God's going to make a name for himself through the way that he governs. And man is going to be governed perfectly. Not by socialism or communism or fascism or even greedy capitalism. Instead, man will have the freedom and the power to live by the law of love, the law of God, the way of God, love for God and love for neighbor. Let me close with Micah chapter 4 again, please. Micah chapter 4. Micah chapter 4. The statement we read from Isaiah is repeated here through the first several verses about Christ's way of governing. And then in verse 4, we read the results. Micah 4, verse 4. But everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree. That doesn't mean it's all they do. It means that they have a place of peace and quiet and security and relaxation. Everyone shall sit under his vine and under his fig tree, and no one shall make them afraid. Wow. No one shall make them afraid of anything. For the mouth of the Eternal of Hosts has spoken. For all people walk each in the name of his God. We will walk in the name of the Eternal our God forever and ever. We have come to keep the Feast of Tabernacles to learn to fear the Eternal always. Forever and ever. Let's rejoice in that wonderful opportunity.